two dots sticker and don't know what to do with it. I noticed this trend a couple of weeks ago when they started appearing, is people would take the sticker off and stick it to their noses, and they called this the pig nose. Get someone to take a picture of you and then post it to Flickr. I'm not sure why this is a popular thing to do, but I've seen people do this quite a bit. So. Anyway, as you heard, I'm Jeremy Gwandi from Yahoo, and I inadvertently stole the title of my talk from the open source conference that's going to be in Portland in a few weeks. This was a subconscious thing. I thought it was a great idea for a name for a talk because I had some ideas of things I wanted to talk about. You submitted it, and then I was looking at the website for OSCON, and I was like, oh, I think I stole the title of my talk from these guys. So hopefully they don't mind. Who am I? I've been a long time Yahoo, which apparently long time nowadays means you've been at the company more than 3 years. The reality is, when I started 5.5 years ago, it was a third of the size it is now. We've got quite a number of employees. I spent my first 3 years in Yahoo Finance, then spent a year as our sort of in-house MySQL guru, doing support and training infrastructure, help and things like that. And then I moved into Yahoo Search about a year ago, which is where I am today. I'm also a blogger. I have a weblog. The URL is basically my name slash blog. And I am the author of an O'Reilly book called High Performance MySQL that just happens to be for sale at the O'Reilly booth here. I actually didn't know they were selling it, so I'm thrilled. It's great. Go buy a copy. That's sort of me in a nutshell. So for sort of the setting the mindset of this talk, I don't want to get into religious debates or what's open and what's free and things like that, but sort of the mentality of what's open nowadays, when I think of looking to the future, how things today that we see on the internet are, I think, signs of what we're going to see more of in the future. Some of it is the real basic stuff that we've had for a long time. I mean, the reason the web, one of the reasons the web is as popular as it is because the early browsers had the view source command, which meant that you could learn how to do this stuff by looking at what other people did, taking their code, and then seeing what effects incremental changes had to it. That's how a lot of people learned the blink tag, I'm sure. And it worked for HTML, it works for JavaScript, and being able to do that, I think, has been great for the spread of web technology and really getting people the tinkering mindset when it comes to learning this stuff. I mean, I learned to program years and years ago by copying program listings out of magazines onto my Commodore 64 with the tape drive, and then making changes to the code to see how it worked. And it was a lot more tedious back then, let me tell you. Open source, of course, is open. All the LAMP technology that's going into building web applications today, everything from the low-level stuff in the operating system to the high-level scripting languages, is all open source. It's all freely available, and it's really what makes a lot of this stuff go nowadays. The same thing is true of more and more of the clients on the desktop side. Firefox, I think, is the best example of that, with something close to 10% market share nowadays, and quite a bit more when you start looking at technology-heavy websites. You know, I've heard reports of 30%, 40%, 50% of traffic being from Firefox now. And then the internet infrastructure itself primarily is all open technology, all open standards. The only example I could think of that had any sort of real administration and process over it that didn't make it easy for someone else to get in was DNS, which is sort of centralized by nature because it just has to be. But that's only on the server side. On the client side, anyone can query DNS and get what they need back. So, by and large, the internet infrastructure itself was created in an open fashion. It supports all these sort of applications we're seeing in the future. One disclaimer I should make, I guess, is I'm actually not going to talk a lot about what we've done at Yahoo because I think a lot of that isn't terribly new. If this was earlier in the year, I'd talk about what we're doing with the developer network. If you do want to check it out, look at developer.yahoo.com. You can see all our APIs and the cool stuff we're doing there. I'm more interested in what some of the trends we're seeing nowadays are, and what I think they point to in the future. And one of those trends is sort of the rise of APIs, which you've been hearing about. You know, we've seen this with a lot of large companies. We've seen this with the BBC now with Backstage. And I actually think of two different things when I think of APIs. One is the traditional APIs where you are querying a remote service and getting a response back in XML that has been spec'd out to some degree. And, you know, we've got our developer network, eBay, PayPal have theirs, Amazon has one, Google has one, BBC is working on that. But there's also the whole syndication world, RSS and Atom, that primarily is being pushed out now from blogging. I mean, blogging, to some degree, has really been the thing that's made RSS incredibly popular. But I think RSS has applications that go far, far beyond what we're seeing today with simple syndication of personal web blogs and things like that. For a long time now, there's been this notion of having this sort of semantic web, or this machine-readable web, where computers can talk to each other and freely exchange data in XML. And this was the promise ever since XML was invented. But if you look at what's happened, the only really big success story with machine-to-machine communication over some XML standard has been RSS. And RSS isn't exactly that standard. There's like 8 variations of RSS out there. But it's more successful than anything else that's been tried so far. And I think the simplicity of RSS and the flexibility there is why we're seeing a lot of this new stuff happening. So I have a quick survey. I'm going to ask some questions. I want to see a show of hands. How many of you have used Delicious on a regular basis here? Okay, good number of people. That means I guessed the crowd pretty well when I was putting this together. How many of you use Flickr? Cool. Okay, same people. Look at that. How many of you use their APIs? And how many of you have written your own tools that use their APIs? Okay, that's kind of what I expected. And that kind of leads to the last question, which is, when you're looking at a new service, how many of you really want there to be an API there so you know that you can get your data out even if you're never going to use it? Okay, just about everyone. That's the interesting thing I see about websites that have APIs, is that a lot of people really want to see an API there. We all want the security to know that our data isn't locked up in there, we can get out at any time, even if we never query that API. That's something that I think a lot of people that go out advocating every website needs an API do it sometimes for the wrong reason. It's not necessarily just because people are going to do all these cool tools that are going to remix your data with data from the BBC and Google Maps and Yahoo News and all sorts of stuff like that. It may be simply because it provides a level of security. You can get all your stuff back out of the service. You're not creating content that's going to help some company that you have no interest in. And if you decide to abandon the service, you can't get what you put into it back out. Anyway, so I went through this. I spent most of the day yesterday at the BBC talking to a bunch of people there and gave a small presentation. And in preparing to do that, I was trying to convey some of the scale of some of the things that we do and the things we have at Yahoo. So I came up with a series of lists, and I was trying to group things together based on the number we had. You know, there are certain things we had. I thought we had dozens of, and hundreds of, or thousands of, or millions of, or billions of. And I made that list. And the funny thing is, if I made those lists and I read them myself in the right order, they sort of led to some other conclusions that really formed the idea for this talk. So the first one was, we have dozens, there are certain things we have dozens of. You know, we've got a few handfuls of what? Well, supported languages. You know, we don't deal with every spoken or written or read language out there, but we deal with something in the order of, I don't know, 30 or 40 or 50 languages. And then we have a similar number of countries out there that we're dealing with in terms of serving content to and having registered users in those countries. You know, it's not in the hundreds or thousands, certainly, because there aren't thousands of countries. Same thing is true data centers. We tend to try to put our physical infrastructure close to the users so that response times aren't much of an issue. We also have dozens of, you know, products and services, everything from Yahoo Mail, Instant Messenger, Search, News, Sports, Fantasy Baseball, you name it. We've got all sorts of stuff out there. But again, I don't think it's in the hundreds unless there's a bunch of stuff I'm forgetting about. And we also already have dozens of APIs out there for various services too. Now, some of these APIs have been around for, you know, 3 or 4 years already, and haven't been exposed to the public. They've been APIs that were set up specifically for some partners to use. But as we've been exposing more and more APIs to the public with the launch of what we were calling YSDN at the beginning of the year, the Yahoo Search Developer Network, which has quickly morphed into YDN, the Yahoo Developer Network, which was our evil plan all along, was to do it first and then make the rest of the company follow along. And this is something that's really starting to open up, and we're in the, I want to say we're in the dozens now, or we'll be in the dozens very soon in terms of what we're offering. So then I went to thousands. I mean, what do we have thousands of? Well, we have thousands of servers, so there's no doubt about that. I don't know the exact number, and it changes every week as we have more machines, so it's even hard to get an accurate count. Well, so it's hard for me to have an accurate count and keep updating it, I should say. And we've got thousands of employees now. We've got something on the order of, I think, 8,200 or 8,500 employees worldwide, which is pretty astonishing. I started, we had about 2,000. And we're almost four times as large as when I started a few, you know, 5 years ago. Now, when I go into the bigger numbers, what are things that we have hundreds of thousands of, or even a few million of, that I can think of off the top of my head? Well, surprisingly, this is the kind of stuff that I think we're familiar with. RSS feeds that we're producing. We produce RSS feeds for lots of different things. Search is one of the ones that a lot of people don't know about. You can do a news search in Yahoo News, and on the results page, you have the options to get, there's an orange XML button there. You know, as bad as that orange XML button is in terms of usability, it's there because it signifies something to people that actually know what it's for. So you can get dynamic RSS feeds from search results from Yahoo News. Well, it turns out that you can do the same thing for our web search, for our image search, and our video search. And we haven't been promoting this very heavily because I don't think the general population cares about getting an RSS feed of a web search for your own last name on a daily basis. But for people who want that, you can get it. It's there. And there are people subscribing to these, and the numbers are going up every single day. Yahoo News also offers topical RSS feeds. So we've got RSS feeds for, you know, the top world news stories, the top US stories, the top medical stories, the top political stories, and things like that. So the category-based feeds that I think are more mass appeal to the typical web user out there who just wants to get some interesting content, whether it's on their desktop and an aggregator, or if it's on a website like Mayotte or something like that. Of course, Flickr, which we acquired earlier this year, has been pumping out heaps of RSS feeds. I didn't even ask them for a count, but you know, they've got RSS feeds for just about every view, every page you can navigate on the Flickr site has an associated RSS feed. Whether it's a group photo pool, a group message board, individuals' most recent photos for a particular tag, a tag across the whole site, newest photos, all sorts of stuff like that. That we're pumping out RSS and ad feeds for. So that's easily in the hundreds of thousands, and I'm pretty sure it's possibly in the low millions by now. The flip side of that is we're also consuming our RSS feeds. My Yahoo, about 2 years ago, we opened up the ability to add any source of content to My Yahoo that produces an RSS feed, which was a huge change because for years, all of the big portal sites that had a My something, whether it was My Yahoo, My Insight, or My Way, or whatever the heck is out there, we all had basically the same model, which was think of the most popular stuff that's going to satisfy, you know, the 80 or 90% of the population that's going to use this every day, and make these choices available. You know, get the deal set up with these companies to add that content. But as we looked around, we said, you know, with all these feeds popping up, and these web blogs, and these semi-pro blogs, and these political blogs during the election years, and things like that, there's a lot of stuff out there that people can't add to My Yahoo. We knew internally that there were employees who were saying, you know, I use My Yahoo less and less as time goes on because I've got an aggregator now. Well, that kind of told us that if we didn't do anything about it, things are going to get interesting as the rest of the internet started pumping out this data. So we have the ability to subscribe to anything that has an RSS feed in My Yahoo. And as a result, we're consuming hundreds of thousands of new RSS feeds that we didn't have before that happened. And also, we were planning to do an RSS/blog search interface, and it got leaked to the press about a week ago, so I guess I can say we're working on something like that. And as you can imagine, we're going to have to consume a lot of RSS feeds to do a good job of that also. So in a sense, we're both producing a lot of this and we're consuming it at the same time. And again, the photos and tags and the tag rating and stuff on Flickr is all stuff that we're pumping out. Now, what about hundreds of millions? I can only think of a couple things that we had in hundreds of millions. It probably means I didn't think very hard enough when I was on the plane ride over here. The first one was queries, and of course, coming from the search universe now, I always think of this as, you know, we deal with hundreds of millions of queries, I think on a daily basis. I don't really remember what the metrics are, but that's the order of magnitude we're talking about in terms of people coming to our site looking for something and telling us explicitly what they want, whether it's a picture of something, a website for something, or they want to buy something through shopping, or looking for a video, or whatever it is. We've got hundreds of millions of those all the time. And then users, there are hundreds of millions of users out there, and something on the order of 350 million of them are actually registered users on Yahoo. That have, you know, they've got the Yahoo username and password, and they've got some data stored in Yahoo. And you know, we get hundreds of millions of users, unique users every month coming to some part of Yahoo to do something. The numbers are getting bigger. Well, billions. There's stuff we have billions of at Yahoo. And this is where it really starts to get interesting. Well, we've got billions of page views on a daily basis. I don't know if it's 2 or 3 or 4, or however many billion it is. We do billions of page views every single day. We also have billions of pages of everything else on the internet indexed so that we can provide a web search product. And we have to have billions and billions of pages indexed to do that. No, I won't say how many billion we have. We also have billions of bits of personalized data out there. One of the things that's always been unique about Yahoo is we've had this huge array of services that we offer, but all you do is you can come to one place, sign up, get user ID and password, and then start personalizing what you see and what you get access to. And that stays with you no matter where you go on the site. So the idea is we want to have these services that are fairly well integrated, and you can personalize just to some degree or another depending on the site. And of course, all that personalization stuff has to get stored somewhere. So we've got this user database, which is a pretty amazing system in and of itself, considering how big it is and the query rate it needs to sustain and the fact that it's replicated all around the world. But there's all this data sitting there that'd be really interesting to do something with. And of course, there's pretty strict limits on what we can do with it for privacy reasons, of course. We've also got billions of mail messages coming into Yahoo Mail every single day. Of course, most of that's spam, but it's still billions of something coming in. The last group is something I've just been starting to call the three R's, which is ratings, reviews, and related metadata. This is content, if you want to call it content, this is content or data or information that those millions of people that come to Yahoo every single day are producing, sometimes implicitly, sometimes explicitly, just as a result of their actions dealing with stuff online, whether it's our music service, whether it's movies or photos or Flickr or anything like that. And this stuff is all accumulating out there on Yahoo, and also out there on the web. There are lots of other services that are seeing the same thing happen, where you start to enable social activity on a website. You start to let people form communities, let them talk about things, let them rate things, let them produce lists, and suddenly you start producing these mountains and mountains of data out there. And the same thing's happening here, and it's happening on many, many other sites. So there's this huge growth in what we're thinking about as sort of user-generated content, and I think it's being fueled by several different things. And some of them are incredibly obvious. One of them is just the increase in connectivity. I was chatting with some folks yesterday about what the broadband situation is like here in the UK, because I remember hearing a couple years ago it was kind of pathetic, and it sounds like it's getting quite a bit better now. I mean, in the US right now, I have both DSL and cable account. And I think my DSL line is at 3 megabits, my cable line is at 4, and it's going to be 6 megabits at the end of the year. And it doesn't cost, they're just upgrading it because the companies are competing with each other, and the cost for me doesn't go up. But that means I can have a fast, always-on connection. The mobile phone world is the same thing is happening, where they're launching these new generation mobile networks where you're getting speeds occasionally that are as good as the first generation DSL we had a few years ago. And conveniently built into those phones is something, you know, admittedly not as good as my new 7-megapixel camera here, but it won't surprise me if we've got those in a couple of years built into camera phones as well. So you see, suddenly people are connected almost everywhere they go, whether it's through a wireless network they got at home or at work, or a wired network, broadband wired network, or just the mobile phone network. That means there's all sorts of opportunities to create little bits of content, or grab little bits of content, or look at something. And more we're seeing people are turning to the internet first in order to do something. I mean, what's the internet replacing? It's replacing catalogs. You've got online sites like Amazon now for shopping. It's replacing phone books. It's replacing the yellow pages for trying to find someone to come over to repair your screen door, or find the plumber and unplug the toilet, or whatever you need. So people are starting to just think first, I'm going to start with the internet. And conveniently enough, many of them start with search. So that means search has got to be really good. And the software that everyone's building, all the new interesting software that I'm seeing launched online now, the small services that are starting up, have some social component to them, whether it's social bookmarking like Delicious or photo sharing, which was obviously what Flickr became popular for. I've seen lots of people working on mobile integration for sort of ad hoc group formation, review sites for, you can find all sorts of review sites for restaurants and movies and plays and all sorts of things like that. And it's happening, just more and more people are baking social concepts into their software. Well, the realization here is that the technology is not really what people care about. It's the fact that the technology enables them to interact with other people. It lets us, as humans, be what we are, which is social creatures, and do it in a way that's less constrained by distance and time than it has been in the past. So, again, the byproduct of all this stuff is this growing amount of data that I think is best captured by, again, those three R's, the ratings, reviews, and related metadata, which are these little. It's not like the, even blog post things are bigger than this, where you sit down and actually write out several paragraphs of stuff. This is the sort of micro-content type stuff that's coming out of all these new activities. And so, some observations about that. I think if you look at where this is going in the future, this data isn't going to all be in the same place. I mean, the big names that we saw there, the ones in the web services game, that obviously we've all got big market share in what we're doing online, we're going to have a lot of this data, but I don't think we're going to have the majority of it. We'll have a lot of it because we have lots of loyal users. But the internet is a really big place, and it's a really big place worldwide, and so that means that this data is going to live in lots and lots of different places. And every new little startup or service that's being built now is building these social components into the software. They're starting to accumulate this kind of data too. And one of my speculations or hopes is that this data will start to become more and more available to the people that own it and other people. And we're seeing examples of this already. The fact that like we've got all the RSS feed that Flickr pumps out. The fact that as a Netflix subscriber, I can get a URL that will be an RSS feed of my Netflix movie rental queue, and I can give that to other people. So that means I can tell a friend of mine, here are all the movies I'm going to be renting to Netflix. If you want to rent some of them too, you can. Or I can share those ratings and reviews with friends of mine. And some services, of course, build that into their model, which is what Amazon does, right? Oh, you bought this book, you might want these other three books too. It's just one click away. God, is that addictive. So the thinking here is, if this more and more of this data gets exposed, and first of all, RSS or Atom, which again is that sort of the only successful mass adoption of machine-to-machine XML we've had on the internet so far, or some of the more complicated stuff will be available through the increasing numbers of web services that are coming online, the true APIs where you're going to issue a query and get some XML response back. And the third one, which is sort of a newcomer in terms of the kind of mindshare it's getting, is this notion of microformats. The idea is you want to come up with a semi-structured way of representing a particular class of data. That could be a bit of metadata about a piece of a multimedia file, a video clip, an audio clip, something like that, calendar information, all sorts of different things, reviews, ratings, and finding a way to represent that in XHTML so that you can either display it in a browser or consume it in some automated way via a search tool or some other aggregation platform that can pull this information together. And once you've got information being made available in really any of these formats, it doesn't matter because suddenly it's all machine readable. And it means we can build all sorts of new stuff on top of this. We've got all this new raw material sitting here waiting for new stuff to happen. So just for some more concrete examples, some of these are rattled off already, some of them I haven't, but I was just jotting off the top of my head the other day, and I thought, well, let me make a list of what some of these things are that I see on a daily basis that are being published that I haven't seen people taking advantage of yet. Not in a big way, at least. Playlists is another one. People publish playlists all the time. I'm currently listening to this song, or here are my top 10 favorite albums, or top 10 favorite tracks, or whatever it might be. Just lists. Movie TV ratings, recommendations, whether it's something online like Netflix or Yahoo Movies, or even something like the information is captured in a personal video recorder like a TiVo. If there was a way to get at that and share it with people, I think it would be interesting. Amazon.com, of course, ratings and reviews. Blog rolls, again, it's just another form of a list online, but it's a list with some implied meaning to it. These are people I trust, these are services I trust, these are things that I read on a regular basis. RSS feeds, of course, being the way to move a lot of data around. Photos, the metadata we've got in Flickr, the tags, the notes, and the comments. There's stuff that's stored on your own computer and on your own desktop if you're a desktop or laptop only kind of person, or this is stored somewhere else if you trust other people with that data. But email is a great example of stuff. There's a lot of information in your email activity that could be used that's not being used today. Like the whole craze that people went through and are still going through about social networking. What the hell is with that? Going through and having to invite all your friends into your network? Tim O'Reilly, I just wrote about this the other day on his web blog on radar.o'reilly.net, I think. Just complaining that no one seems to have figured the obvious out here, and that most social online social relationships are already represented in either email communication or IM buddy lists or IM conversation logs. But no one's really tapped into that to actually construct your real social network out of your day-to-day activity. And the same thing could be true of mobile phone contacts, especially as more and more phones are able to do things like sync address books over Bluetooth and things like that. The effort required to doing this goes down. And technology is waiting to be invented that can start taking advantage of this stuff and building new social applications with it. So what would we do all with all this stuff? What's available? Well, the remix theme has come up a couple times already. I think that's one of the best and easiest to understand things is take some of the data that used to previously live in different silos, whether it was in a particular company silo or in different device silos. Oh, this was in my TiVo, this was in my phone, and this was in my email, and combine those and start to build these new applications or services around them. Bridging those islands, I think, is going to become an important thing that just gets sort of louder and louder over the next few years as people start to do more syndication and web service APIs. I think entertainment's got to be a big piece of this. I mean, social software or social media needs to be fun or people don't do it. You know, if you ask people, if I were to ask people around the room why is it when 90% of people with their hands up are using Flickr, why do you use it? Is it because your friends do? Is it because you enjoy it? Is it because you're too lazy to write your own software? And there's a number of reasons. But usually when I ask people that, one of the ones that comes up all the time is, well, it's fun and it's easy and I get to see what other people are doing. And it just starts sounding a lot more like social human activity and a lot less like software. And I think that's where a lot of this is headed. Another thing to do is becoming more common too, is really giving back and participating in this sort of new economy of consuming third-party data by sharing what you have as well. I think it's no surprise that several of the existing RSS services and the technologies and features of the world also provide RSS feeds of searches that you can subscribe to on their site, which is kind of recursive and hurts your brain if you think about it too hard. But I think is an important model for people to follow is if you're going to consume all this third-party data to do something interesting, it makes sense to also be able to let other people plug into what you're building. In other words, instead of building just a service or a destination, you're also building a platform for other people to stand by. So what's missing? This all sounds great so far, right? All this stuff is out there waiting to be harvested, all this opportunity. But there's a few things that aren't there yet. One of the biggest ones is some notion of portable identity. The fact that I have the same user ID on Flickr and Delicious and on about 10 other websites, I mean, it's because I've got a unique last name, helps a lot, I tell you. I feel really, really sorry for people with common names out there that try to get into a new service when it's been online for a while. But we have no notion of portable identity. There's no good way of representing my identity on different websites and being assured that that's my data on that website, that's my data on that website. And this is, I think, a huge roadblock right now. And they're different. Skip Networks is a company that's been trying to solve this problem, and I don't know if it's going to take off or not. There's this new OpenID group that's floating an idea of another way to do some build an open identity network. It's also very good. It started a couple months ago, I think. But I think that's essential. And until you've got this portable identity out there, the next three things on this slide can't happen either, which I think are going to become incredibly important because the amount of data out there is so huge that we need to be able to do something to make it meaningful, filter out the stuff that we don't want to see. So the next one is really having some notion of a trust network out there. And there's some notion of trust already. In systems like eBay, where there's a reputation system. But out there in the general internet, the only trust people tend to have is trusting their friends or trusting people that they know, which goes back to the whole using real social networks rather than building these fake ones up. But until you can identify people and their content and their recommendations and ratings and reviews on other websites in a reliable way, it's hard to build these trust networks and put them to good use. But I think once you've got that portable identity, you can start on the trust networks. The other thing you can start on is coming up with some authority metric. I put foo ranking here because I don't know what it would be called, because I think it'd be different for every service. But we've got these today in the web search world. Google has something they call PageRank. We have something we call WebRank. You know, the basic ideas are the same, and fundamentally right now it's a popularity contest. But the problem is it's a popularity contest in which most people don't have a vote. The only people who vote in the contest today are people savvy enough to build websites and to know how to create links from one site to another and what, you know, Ahrefs means and all that kind of stuff. That's a pretty small percentage of the population right now. But when the software gets easy enough or starts exposing enough information about the implicit information that people are creating, and we have metrics for things like, you know, restaurant reviews or music reviews or merchant review, there's all sorts of things out there we could be doing. You're going to need to know who to trust and who the most trustworthy sources or most reliable sources on different types of information are. And that's going to require, each domain you're going to is going to have different needs, so they're going to have different ranking algorithms that are going to have to be developed, and nobody's built those yet. And the final one is reputation, which is, in my mind, reputation is a combination of three things. One is getting the trust and authority metrics right. And third is introducing the concept of time, because a reputation is something you build up over time. So that means tracking this stuff over a fairly long period. The app that Ben showed off earlier with someone who was taking BBC content on a regular basis and showing you what changed. Now, if there was a way for people to review those changes and approve or disapprove them or vote on them or something, that over time could turn into a reputation system where this is what the community of BBC readers thinks of this particular journalist's ability to edit their own stories over time, and the ones that are more accurate or make fewer changes as time goes on, maybe they get a higher score, maybe they don't. I don't know. That kind of stuff hasn't really been built yet, but it's going to happen sooner or later. So what's at risk with doing all this kind of stuff? Why hasn't it happened yet? Why aren't people pushing for it? Well, one of the main problems is that a lot of companies out there today have this notion of, they're scared. They don't want to give out too much data, because if you give out too much data, you're giving away your business. And the reason is that one of the main methods that they think of for capturing and keeping news is this notion of lock-in or data lock-in. If we make all our data available, all our users' data available to them in an easy to export format, then they'll walk away, right? Well, there's a possibility, I think, that some percentage of them would, but if your users start leaving in droves, it usually means there's a better product out there, and you're not doing a pretty good job. Or that your product is degrading over time or something like that. That was one reason why I asked that question earlier about APIs and whether or not you actually use the API or you just want to see it available. I think having that sort of feature available is incredibly important, because most of the people won't take advantage of it. But there are people who require it, and there are a lot of people who really want to see it there for their own security and knowing that they can get access to data again. I think there's this notion of the perceived costs also, which is similar in thinking to some of the commercial versus non-commercial discussions that happen a lot when people start to expose their services. But the thinking here is, well, why should we give all this stuff away for free that we spend? We've got these developers we're paying for this infrastructure or equipment or bandwidth, all this stuff, and you want us to go give them stuff away for free? That doesn't help us make us any money. And that's true. There is a perceived cost there, but I think what people forget to factor in is some of the possible rewards that come as a result of opening things up. The trouble is, we're not very good at quantifying this yet. The companies that have been early leaders in this area and have been getting something back from the community when they open up, none of us have done a very good job of saying what that is, and I don't think any of us have ever actually talked about trying to put a dollar amount on that yet. But if that did start to happen, I think more people's minds would start to change. And the last one is, there are a lot of legal gray areas here. I won't go into what all those are. I think some of them are self-evident already. Most of them I put on the sticking point slide, which is things like copyright and DRM. I don't think DRM is going away, but it's still a major barrier to doing things with the entertainment industry, because you get involved with the movie or music industries or even television, and things get really interesting when you want to talk about remixing media and things like that. The DMCA, which is one of those rules that we have in the United States that was passed in a stroke of pure genius, it has all sorts of interesting implications in it for having having people cause you to do a lot more work than you should have to because they think you might have violated a bit of their intellectual property. Software patents are also an interesting issue in this too. What if you open up a service and then someone else uses your data or builds on top of your service, something that is a great enhancement to your service or could have been a separate business, and then go off and patent a bunch of the software and algorithms required to do it? Something you can't even participate unless you pay them a license fee. That's kind of weird. But that's kind of the state of the world today. So what can we do in the meantime? What should we be doing? I think we should be encouraging several things. One is those three things I talked about earlier: syndication, making sure that sites that can be providing data for you to use and for other people to use are doing that through RSS and ATOM, or embed using microformats so they can embed the data right in the web pages we're already doing today, and starting to expose more and more through APIs, and just getting people's heads around this notion of openness and the fact that being open isn't gonna make your business go away. And if you're in a position where you can, you know, lead by doing. Start doing some of this stuff and showing other people what the benefits are. I think more and more of this is going to start to progress the way it ought to. You know, looking at that huge amount of data and all this opportunity for building new stuff requires some people to take a leap of faith and demonstrate that being open is good. I took this picture yesterday at the BBC because I thought it was pretty cool the way that they're just getting the message out there of what the benefit of some of this stuff is to normal people. You know, the find it, rip it, mix it, share it, come and get it. I mean, that's something that most people can relate to, or at least most people who have who were born in the last 30 years or so. I know a lot of people still don't have quite understand what the point of an MP3 file or an iPod is, but that's changing over time. But if you look at it, you talk to people who are in high school now or graduated from college now, and look at how they're using technology and compare it to how people were using technology in the same situation 5 or 10 years ago, it's completely different. A lot of the stuff that the BBC has been pushing for, that the Creative Commons have been pushing for, this is a shot of our Creative Commons specific search on Yahoo Search, a lot of stuff that they've been pushing for have been running assumptions in many of the people who have sort of, the internet has been around as long as they've been alive, this stuff is built in. There are assumptions about what you should and shouldn't be able to share, but the people running companies and controlling media today don't quite understand that yet. So that was my main message for today, because I want to talk about that. I'm taking questions about any of this stuff, about Yahoo, about whatever, and also that we are hiring careers at Yahoo.com where you go to find out for jobs. Thanks. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there's two levels of that. The first one is, and this is something I've been advocating quite a bit to certain groups within Yahoo, is just that they need to open up. They need to open up APIs for things that people commonly, things I think of as infrastructure tools that people commonly use, but don't necessarily want to have to go to the website to use it. A good example of that is we provide a service called Yahoo Calendar that a lot of people use for just keeping track of appointments and whatever it is they need to keep track of. But there are a lot of times where I don't want to go to the website in order to do that. I may want to write a simple app that can go and post things to my calendar because maybe I'm on a mobile device that we don't happen to support yet officially, but I could write an application for it that would interface with it. And there are lots of examples like that where, whether it's because you're on some weird device or you're in an application environment that we don't know about, it should be perfectly acceptable for you to store some of your data with this, especially if it's the same type of data you've been storing anyway. And I think that's coming. One of the things that the web services world is really lacking right now. I should have put this up on list somewhere too. Is a good simple mechanism for authenticating users through web service interface. Because in order to the vast majority of the services you see up there are sort of read only public style web services. There's not a lot of authentication going on, or it's sort of this obfuscated thing like, well, yeah, here's the URL you need to access your thing, and it's got this big long hash in it you wouldn't have been able to guess, but of course you can share it with anyone. So it's not truly secure. So until there's a good standard way of doing authentication, every company has to come along and invent their own. We're inventing our own because we have particular requirements in-house about how we do authentication to prevent abuse and prevent all sorts of problems. And we'll have to release a web service API for that. Once we do that, it opens up the door to all sorts of applications where you might want to store some of your data on Yahoo. You may want to add things to your Yahoo calendar, or manipulate your stock portfolios, or your fantasy sports league, or whatever it might be. And so that's one of the things I've been advocating internally. And there are a lot of people who want to do that because there's sort of three perspectives on that. One is it's just good for us in general because it gives people a way to continue interacting with Yahoo. Another one is it's showing people more open. And the third one is, and this is the sort of corporation, making money off people who do work for free, right? Well, we open up the API and suddenly people are building clients for us, so we don't have to worry about it. You're on a platform that we don't support as well for that particular service, someone may come along and build that for it. And then the flip side of it, I think, is the larger multi-company or multi-service world, which is what you were kind of hinting at with the blogger example, is that you've got services out there, lots of competing services, that offer very similar tools, very similar functionality, and no one's really come forward and said, here's the API that everyone should adopt. For many successful things, we've seen that. The Atom API is probably going to be the de facto standard in the blogging world because it's got, I think, enough momentum there. But in most other lower level stuff, that's a prerequisite for success, right? In order for email servers to talk to each other, they all have to agree on SMTP. For web browsers and clients, they have to agree on HTTP and all of those things. And the notion of just bare bones, the notion of not competing at the protocol level has to bubble up now at the web service level. It hasn't quite happened yet across the board.
Can I just ask, as a follow-on on the sort of security and authentication question, now you've got one service is going to be interacting with a number of your other services in order to bring data together in the same place. You're going to end up having to store passwords for those services on the core service, but you can't hash those passwords completely because they're going to be sent across to service B. What's going to be the solution for that?
Well, that's a good question. So the interesting problem we're dealing with is recognizing up front that some of the applications that may use our web service interfaces are sort of desktop or client applications that are on a notebook or a desktop or a mobile phone where you can store the password locally and the user's probably completely comfortable with that because they're doing it already with an IM client or something or an email program or something like that. But when you start looking at the fact that it's sometimes services talking about the services, we start to think about we don't necessarily want some other service out there to have, 100,000 of our users' Yahoo login credentials on the service because suddenly our security becomes only as strong as the weakest link out there. And honestly, there are a lot of it takes an incredible amount of work to get security right on the web, and a lot of companies haven't figured this out yet. And so we don't want to put ourselves at risk because some third party out there has convinced 100,000 users that they've got a great way of aggregating our contact with someone else's if only you give us the username and password to use to access Yahoo. So that's something we're working through. There's a group that's trying to figure out the right way to get access to our content. And I don't know what the answer is going to be yet because I haven't talked to those guys about what they're building, but there are a couple different scenarios I can think of, and there aren't anything new in the industry. One is you can do some sort of authentication scheme where each service gets a different version of your login credentials. So it's not just a username password pair. It's maybe it's a username, some special magic key, and then a service provider type token, the combination of which are strong enough to get in and authenticate you. And most of the scenarios like that end up meaning that the initial linking process, the initial sign-up process on the third-party site ends up being more complicated because you may have to go there, get bounced off to our site to verify that you initiated the request and then come back or something like that. Again, I don't know what the answer is going to be, but it's a problem we have to solve right the first time, or it's a huge can of worms.
Well, my name is Matt. This is a question about the early culture. I used to work on search, and that just before you arrived, and it was being in Europe, it was really, really difficult to get on the ship to accept anything that you were doing, and sort of make it all basically, I think, more on a practicality than anything else, the stuff we were doing and stuff that Korea were doing particularly. Has this sort of kind of openness to the outside world really helped with that internal openness, or I mean, has there been a sea change in culture? Or?
Yeah, there have been a lot of changes internally. I mean, I think one thing that's changed since you left, since about the time I came on, is that we were in pretty serious integration mode at that time, because we had bought up a couple of companies that were in the search world and trying to merge their technology with our technology and do all sorts of things like that. So that the primary mandate was get it all working.
And then
worry about the enhancements, which means a lot of the hey, really great ideas stuff just couldn't get implemented right away. But there have been some interesting changes internally. One of the problems you have in any large organization, two problems. One is you start having a siloing problem where the people who work on the finance property management talk to the sports people and then talk to the search people, which is a problem you can solve, but that problem tends to also reflect itself in the systems that people design. And it means the systems don't necessarily talk to each other, because when we design them, they never thought they'd need to. And so that means if you've got some great new idea, an internal idea for remixing or blending some of our services, it's tricky because you are at the mercy of a group that you have no authority over, who has their own timelines for building and shipping products that you really can't influence unless you've got some really important friends in the company. And so what we've done is created a new group of people internally who's not sole job, but one of their main jobs is to serve as the intermediary between people with the great ideas for prototyping something new and the people who are the owners of the data they need access to get the job done. And they're going to work with those groups to either get access to the data and get them to build APIs, or they'll build the APIs themselves. You know, if I come up with an idea that says, well, I need access to our web map, which is the map of where all the links point to all the other links on the web. I need access to that, I need access to our shopping database, and I need access to the real-time quote stream from finance. How do I get that? Rather than having to do all that work myself, I can enlist this group to help me out, and they're going to be interfacing with them on a regular basis. So we're trying to make it so that if you want to prototype or build and showcase some new idea, you spend most of your time focusing on the new idea and what's unique to what you're building, rather than all the sort of plumbing work necessary that you would have to do if you're really going to launch it, just to prototype it. So that in my mind is one of the biggest changes internally.
I think we have time for one more question, and then we put the field signs on your fingers. I'm doing my thing.
You were talking about the problems with moving to this new, more semantic kind of world, and one of them was user identification. But I think another really big problem being thing identification. So we've got an ISBN for books, and so you can go to one site and get the ISBN, and then go to another site to find out what people think about that book, because you've got that stamp key between them. And we don't really have that for, say, your Netflix example, where you can get your queue for Netflix and then ask people what they think about that movie, because there's no standard identification for movies.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that as being one of these missing links, and perhaps do you see a company that already tries to classify everything in the world as maybe being people who start to provide that?
Yeah, and that's a very real problem, not being able to uniquely and unambiguously identify in a way that everyone can agree on the things that you're talking about, the objects, whether they're things that you're buying or recommending or commenting on or whatever they might be. And that's one of those problems that never seems to go away with a big open system where lots of people can play. Because it's very hard to make the incentive to all agree significant enough that people actually buckle down and do that work. I think a lot of the popularity in tagging right now is another example of the tension between we need one standard way to identify everything, and well,
the other side of the coin, which is, well, maybe if we just let everyone sort of identify it the way they think it should be identified, if enough people do it, we'll start to be able to see the patterns, and maybe we'll get 80% of it right, which is better than not having any of it right. I don't know how this is going to play out, but it is a real problem, and that's something that I think in some cases can be solved at sort of an industry level, like in the case of movies, if there's truly not a way to identify movies uniquely, that's a problem the movie industry never really addressed. We've got that with books and several other products. I don't know what the answer to that's going to be. It's tricky because I think history has shown that the only time a standard like that works is when it's either owned by a third party, sort of independent third party that doesn't have a huge stake in the game, or it's a third party that was created by several of the biggest players at the time who all said, well, we're all going to get together and agree that something has to get done, and no one of us can own it because then the other one won't trust it. But I don't know how that's going to shake out for the huge list of things that you could probably make where that would be nice to have.
It'll be good when it happens. Ladies and gentlemen,
please show your appreciation.